Blog Talk Radio.
You listening to the Radio Infidel Show, live from the USA, bringing you the truth, the facts, and the light. And now, here's Jay.
Well, welcome to the Radio Infidel Show. Jay here, and my co-host, Jorge, and a special co-host, George, the executive producer from our sister show, The Not Sorry Show. Welcome, Jorge. Welcome, George. Now, what's special about my two co-hosts is George was our executive producer back when we did the original show on Johnny Gosch, and Jorge was a producer and did a blockbuster report on the crime. Jorge, George, I know you remember in 2017 when we did this story on the kidnapping of Johnny Gosch.
Oh, yeah. How can I forget it? Go ahead, George.
No, I was just going to say, yeah, absolutely. How could we possibly forget? I mean, it was an epic, emotionally charged, really important show, and I think all of us recognize the importance of it when we did it. And with that said, I will say that the report and the research that Jorge did on it, fantastic, top flight for sure.
Yeah, that was one of the toughest shows I've ever done in my life, and I had to say I cried in the production of it. But it did reveal the ties to the CIA and to other White House officials, which I won't get into detail now, but it was shocking to find out just how far this has gone and how far it's been happening for such a long time. And Johnny was one of the, if I'm not mistaken, one of the first original children on milk carton.
I think he was actually the second child ever on the infamous milk carton.
Yeah. So I know this is heartbreaking for Noreen, and I'm so glad she's able to have the strength and courage to continue the story and go forward. I know it's the toughest thing as a mother. And I'm very interested to see what new development she has for us. I know she wrote a new book about it, and I'm sure she has interesting stories to tell tonight.
It was a tough show. You know, George, I remember, you know, we had like three of the reporters who said, you know, during the two-week research, they didn't think they could do the show.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Robin was one that showed up. I remember that.
Yeah, Robin's report. I also remember your report, Jorge, and you said, and I quote this, "This child is not missing. He was kidnapped."
Oh, yeah, that's obvious. He was followed. He was kidnapped. He was seen by neighbors. They found his newspapers, all the undistributed newspapers that everybody called in to complain about because they hadn't received them. So he was tracked down. He was purposely followed, and used for purposes that God only knows, you know. And then that infamous picture of the three boys gagged and tied that was left on Noreen's porch. I'm sure she'll get into that.
Oh, yeah. You know, we did get through the story, and it was the most listened and downloaded shows we ever did. So let's kind of get into it a little bit. On a pleasant September morning in 1982, a 12-year-old boy disappeared in West Des Moines, Iowa. His name was Johnny Gosch. What transpired that day was the beginning of a worldwide eye-opener to the atrocities of pedophilia and child trafficking in America. One woman, Noreen Gosch, Johnny's mother, out of grief and desperation, began a personal mission to reveal the truth behind her son's kidnapping and expose an unbelievably politically cover up. Now, we can pontificate, talk about, speculate all we want. Many have. One thing for sure is this was a crime. This kidnapping changed the face of missing children. There's only two people that can tell this crime, Johnny and his mother, Noreen. We are blessed to have Noreen Gosch with us tonight, Johnny's mother. Welcome, Noreen Gosch. Do we have Noreen?
Yes, I'm here.
Hey, welcome, love.
Thank you so much for having me on the show.
And well, we want to thank you for coming. Go ahead.
And for doing Johnny's show originally about him in 2017, it means a lot when you have a case like this and people still remember. It means a great deal.
Well, we want to thank you for coming on. I know you don't do many of these interviews, so we're grateful. So nobody better to tell the real crime. Now, Noreen, we're going to have you tell the real crime, kidnapping
okay.
Johnny.
Okay.
We're going to give you a little break halfway through. So let's begin the start of the crime. You received some odd phone calls the morning of Johnny's kidnapping.
We did. We had phone calls that came in. It was always a Saturday night in the wee hours of the morning. And right around 1:30 to 2 o'clock in the morning. And this happened a couple weekends before he was kidnapped and then the morning of the kidnapping. And I didn't answer the phone because the phone was on the other side of the room. So Johnny's father answered. And I heard him say, yes, yes, okay. Well, I woke up when I heard the phone ring, and I said, well, who was that at this hour? And he said, well, it was a wrong number. And I said, you had a conversation with a wrong number? And then he just put down the phone, and that was the end of that. Well, then in the morning, a few hours later, we woke up to the phone ringing and the neighbors saying that they had not received their newspaper. And Johnny was meticulous about having his papers delivered on time because he was a pretty smart kid and he figured out pretty quickly that when you have late papers and there's complaints, it costs the paper boy money. And he enjoyed his little job, and it was a good type of thing for kids to be able to do. It began to teach them about the work ethic, and it was not a bad thing for kids, except that they were out at that hour of the morning. And someone always went with Johnny. He never went alone until that morning. And for some reason, he would set his alarm clock and he'd get up and come in and wake us up. And then one of us would go with him on the paper route. And that morning he didn't come in and wake anybody up. He went out on the route alone. The only thing that he took with him was our little dog. They were buddies. And the dog went with him. But by the time we received phone calls that people didn't get their papers, I went to the phone right away and answered, and Johnny's dad went out to try to find him on the route, thinking that he was just maybe running late that morning and that he would help him finish the route. But when he got to the corner about a block and a half away from our home, he found Johnny's wagon full of newspapers. The bundles had not even been cut. And he always took the wagon on Sunday mornings because the papers were bigger, thicker, and heavier. So he pulled the wagon. And during the week when he delivered the papers, it was a thinner, smaller paper. So he just had his newspaper bag. But Sunday mornings was always the wagon. And all the papers were in the wagon. Not one of them had been delivered yet.
Now, Maureen, real quick, let's dispel some myths.
Okay.
Johnny was not upset. There was no argument at home.
Oh, no. No. And he was eager to get his route done that morning because we were going to go to the lake for the day, and he was going to get to bring along his close school friend. His name was Mark. And they were good friends. And Mark was going to go along with us to the lake that day. And we had a boat. So he was eager to get his route done, come home, and get ready to go have a fun day. And that was our plan. Well,
okay, so folks, He was not upset. He did not run away. Go
no,
ahead, Maureen.
No, he did not run away at all. Johnny had a perfect service award for every month that he had the paper route, which was well over a year, meaning he never had a late paper. There was never any issues with his delivery of papers. And he was very proud of that record. And this was a big deal for him. It was he just managed it like a business, which it was. And it taught the kids how to, collect the money, because back then a lot of people did not pay the office directly for their newspaper. They paid the paper boy. And so now it's all different. And in Iowa, anyway, they don't have kids delivering papers at all anymore. Now it's all adults. And that was Johnny's kidnapping, followed by Eugene Martin's, that changed all of that. Parents wouldn't let their kids go out anymore.
Yeah, and it wasn't just, Des Moines. It was
all over.
It changed the country.
It did. And the morning of the kidnapping, then, after Johnny's father came back to the house and said, "You call the police right away. Something's happened to Johnny. His newspapers are sitting in the wagon. He didn't even get to deliver even one of them." And so I dialed the police right away. And then while we were waiting for the police to come, I called the manager that Johnny reported to for the Des Moines Register, and I got the names of the other kids that picked up papers at the corner where Johnny would go to get them before delivery. And I called each one of their homes, and that's when the other paper boy, one of the boys, was the best witness of all, because he saw so much detail. And he reported to me the style, the color of the car, the description of the man that pulled in right there, detaining the kids, asking questions. And when that happened, the guy made a U-turn right in the middle of a busy street and came around. He spotted Johnny walking towards the paper drop, and kept hollering to him, "Hey, kid, come here. And the other paper boys could hear him. Well, when Johnny didn't stop to talk to the guy, he kept walking till he got to the corner where the other kids were located. They were all folding their papers, and then they would set out to deliver them. Well, Johnny got to the corner. The guy in the car made a U-turn, came back up, and pulled right in where the kids were dealing with their papers. And the man was slurring his words. They thought that perhaps he was drunk. Then Johnny said to the other kids, "This guy is scaring me. There's something wrong here. I'm going home." So Johnny started down the street with our little dog, and he got about half a block away from the corner. The man that drove in with the car and was detaining the kids all of a sudden jumped back in his car, because he had slid over to the passenger side and opened that door and swung his feet out on the pavement. And that man pulled himself back into the car, started it, and then he flicked the dome light 3 times before he took off. Just then, after he flicked the dome light 3 times, the other paper boys saw another man come down from between 2 houses and right back behind Johnny. He just followed Johnny down the rest of the block. At that point, I don't think Johnny knew he was being followed. Then they heard our dog start to growl. And then Johnny turned the corner, which would be the correct way to go back to our house. He turned the corner with his wagon. And a few seconds later, they heard the screech of tires. They saw that same car run the stop sign, turning left, which would take them north and west, away from
so,
our place.
Noreen, do you remember what description the other child gave, like the type of car, white
yes.
man, black man?
It was a Ford Fairlane or a Mercury Zephyr, because they both had the same body style, and it was blue over blue, a lighter blue over a darker blue. That was the car, four-door. The man's description was dark hair, mustache, dark complected, and they thought that he was perhaps Spanish, was the description and what the kids thought. And we even took the one witness who was much more detailed in his information. We took him to the car dealership to pick out the paint colors. Our detectives did. And he picked out the exact paint colors of the car. And the colors of vehicles do change under mercury vapor streetlights count of what he saw. And they matched up for that year. I think they felt it was a 1981 vehicle at the time. One of our witnesses, there was a teenage boy who was 16, and he was very, very good with remembering what he saw. Then there was also a 44-year-old attorney who had pulled his car up to pick up his son's papers that morning. Well, he saw the man too, and he got a partial license plate because he agreed to go through hypnosis. And they were able to get a partial license plate that way. And it turned out to be a stolen plate. However, at least he was able to remember something through the hypnosis. And he fought for us because when we called the police, when I did, it took him an hour and 10 minutes to get to our home. And we lived 10 blocks from the police department. They weren't in any particular hurry to come. By the time they reached our home, I already had talked to the manager of the newspaper, got all the names of the kids that were at the corner that morning and of the attorney that was there, and I talked to several of them to get the story of what happened, and I had it all written down for the police by the time they got there. And when the cop came in, he said, well, you know, has your son ever run away before? I said, no, he has never run away, ever, including today. He was kidnapped. Something has happened to him. This is what the witnesses said, and I had that all written out, and I gave it to the policeman, and we filled out their missing persons report, and then we did not see another person from any law enforcement until about 2 or 3 in the afternoon that day, after they had been to our home once in the morning to take the report. However, we started calling people, friends of ours in different parts of the city, asking them if they would organize a search party, if some of their neighbors would go out and look in some of the isolated areas. They went to the state park to look there. We were just frantic trying to think of where would somebody go with him. So they went to isolated areas. In the one state park, a police car rolled up in the afternoon, and there was about 25 people in that search party. The police chief got out of the squad car and stood up on a picnic table with a bullhorn, and he yelled to the crowd, everybody just go home. This kid is nothing but a goddamn runaway.
I remember that. But yeah. Now, this police chief was a true Pete. I promise I won't cuss. But he was a real piece of work.
He was. So following that, all of those people that were at the state park came to my home all 20 plus of them. There was either 23 or 25 of them that came. And they said, we thought you needed help. But they were upset and angry. And I said, we do need help. And then they told me what the police chief did. And I said, we've got 5 witnesses. Why is he calling Johnny a runaway? Well, nobody ever answered that as to why the cop did that, other than he was just a loose cannon or kind of a piece of work, etc. Well, that didn't sit with me. And the searches went on and all of that, each one yielding nothing. And then I noticed an article in the paper 2 weeks after Johnny was kidnapped, where 2 girls from Des Moines were picked up off the street. They were aged 13 and 14, and they were taken to Omaha, Nebraska, 2 hours from where Des Moines is. And they were being used for prostitution over there. And somehow or other, police found them, and they were returned home. So I took that article to the police department, and I said, would you please call the Omaha police chief and check on this? Because the description of the man that the girls gave was that he was of Spanish descent, dark hair, darker complected, mustache, the very same description as the man that they described in the car that took Johnny. Well, the police chief said he wouldn't do that because he didn't think it'd be anything. And I said, well, I'm not asking if you think it is anything. I'm asking you to check if it's something. Well, he didn't and wouldn't. So they had called in the state police. They were there at the police department a couple of times. And they were about as worthless as the police chief, not wanting to do much of anything. So we
think back to that time, if you would.
Mm-hmm.
What has to be going through your head that these people are playing this like,
yeah,
you know, it's, I mean, you've got to be frantic. You've got to be thinking WTF.
Well, the red flags were flying every time I dealt with one of them. And I thought, my God, my training in crime was watching Cagney and Lacey on TV. And I at least knew that because in all these cop shows on TV, they usually have real police advisors. And they try to run the storylines fairly close to what an investigation would be. Well, this didn't match any TV show I ever saw. So then we called the FBI. They sent over 2 agents, and they informed me that they were special agents. And the minute they stepped into the front door, came in, they said, well, we're just coming as a courtesy because you called. We have no intention of entering the case. I said, what? Our son has been kidnapped. Kidnapped is a federal crime. And they said, well, you have not proven that your son's life is in danger. That is your responsibility.
Wait a minute. Lori,
yeah.
How is
yeah.
it? The victim's responsibility to prove a crime.
I tell you something, everything that came out of any of their mouths during that time was fake and phony. It didn't follow the letter of the law at all. And so I said, you expect us to prove that his life was in danger. Have you even talked to the witnesses? Well, he said the police chief thinks he's a runaway. And I said, the police chief is a fool. There are 5 witnesses that each saw a portion of that crime. One boy saw Johnny being shoved in a car out of his bedroom window after they had turned the corner when Johnny was walking and this other man was following Johnny. The car was parked just around the corner, but it was in full view of this one kid's bedroom right across the street. And he heard some noise outside, and it was warm weather. The windows were open. So he heard noise outside, and he was awakened. So he looked out, and that's what he saw. Well, the police chief still maintained Johnny was a runaway. So at that point, I quit talking to the police for a few days just for my own well-being, and started hunting for a private investigator. And we got the names of a couple who had had experience with kidnappings. And we found one man that we interviewed in Omaha, and we hired him. Well, the police chief came over to our home in the afternoon, one of those days before the private investigator was on duty. And he said, he was screaming and yelling at me in my own home. And he said, "You don't have the right to hire a private investigator. This is my case. I'm in charge." And I said, first of all, you're going to have to stop yelling, because I have perfect hearing and we don't yell at one another in this home. So you're not going to come into my home and yell at me. Got it? So.
Well, you know, going another crime is that you had to spend your own money to find your child.
Oh, thousands and thousands through the years. It's unbelievable, because there's no insurance for something like this. Well, then that day that the police chief was there telling me that I couldn't hire a private investigator, that I had no rights in this case, I said, "Well, no," I said, "I'm in charge of this case." I said, "You forfeited the right when you stood up on that picnic table drunk, using a bullhorn and dismissing a group of people that were searching for Johnny, yelling at them and calling him blankety blank runaway." I said, "You forfeited. I have hired somebody who will begin working Monday." And when our detectives got to town, they went to the police department with a signed affidavit notarized from us, giving them permission to work on the case and to meet the police chief out of courtesy. And they did that. They went to the police department. Well, later the next morning when they were out working, because they sat a surveillance watching the morning traffic at that corner just to see if by any chance that car would resurface in the area. It did not, but the police from West Des Moines did, and they came over to that location, and they arrested our private investigators, put them in jail.
Oh, wow.
Oh, yeah, right.
What did they charge them with?
They didn't. They just did it because they said that they were disturbing the neighborhood by being there. Well, they weren't. They were parked in a church parking lot, which was empty, watching the traffic flow. They weren't disturbing a soul. And nothing stuck because they got out of jail right away, but they did it to disrupt it. They threw every obstacle they possibly could at us. They did not want us to find out what happened to Johnny. It was that simple, and we knew it.
Now, Noreen, I don't want to throw you off the story, but why do you think, what made you think they were doing this, the police?
Well, we could see what was happening. They disregarded every witness. They kept referring to him as a runaway when he clearly wasn't. They disrupted the investigation with the private investigators. Anything our investigators got, they were willing to share it with the police. And the police didn't want it. They refused to take any reports of any kind. And so eventually, you know, and we didn't really ever get an investigation with the FBI because they weren't going to enter the case, and they didn't. So the day that they came and informed us that they wouldn't enter the case, I said, "Well, then you can get out of my house." And they said, "Well, you can't talk to us that way. We're special agents." And I said, "Well, you don't appear to be very special to me. And if you're not going to help us, and all you're going to do is say that it's my ability to prove that my son is in danger when there are five witnesses to the crime. Then
they were special something. I'll give you that.
Yeah. And I just told him to get out. I said, if you're not going to work with us, then you're in my way. I will run this case as best I can. I'm not a cop, but I have a brain, and I'll do better than you guys. We will find out what happened to Johnny. So they left in a huff, two huffs, because there were two of them. And they were very put out that I ordered them out of the house. But we dug in and we supported our police or our private investigators. Well, our private investigators organized a house to house with everybody that lived within a 2-mile radius of our home. They get to this one man's house, which was down the street for about 3 or 4 blocks and then off on a side street. I got to his house and knocked on the door, and the man came to the door and saw them, and he said, oh, thank God you're here. I've been calling you. And they said, well, no, you haven't called us. Well, the man who lived in the house had been calling the police department, telling them that he saw a car pull up and something was taken from the back seat wrapped in a blanket that he thought was a body and put into a van. And then both vehicles left the area heading north. Well, that became a very prized interview. When the private investigators got finished talking with him and they came back to our home, they said, we're giving you this report. We want you to bury it. Do not share it with the media. Do not share it and talk about it with anyone. And above all, do not give it to the police. So I didn't. Many years went by because we had quite a lull in the case. There were sightings and there were well-meaning people that would call with a lead or what they thought might be good information. So we would give that to our private investigators to check out. And sometimes we would have something good that we could use. And then other times it was helpful, meaning that the people were trying to help, but it didn't fit with the case. So a period of about 8.5 years went by. And all of a sudden, there was a young man that was put in jail over in the Nebraska area. He was held in the prison in Lincoln, Nebraska. A man by the name of Paul Benassi, young man.
Remember it well. I remember it well. I remember that we did that part of our report in 2017, that this guy. But go ahead, Noreen, go ahead.
So in the questioning that his attorney did, which was John DeCamp, was the attorney, who also was a state senator at one time. Paul Benassi told them how the kidnapping happened because he was along with them. And it was his job in the kidnapping to get Johnny to try to come over to their car to lure him. And Paul Benassi then said, after we got Johnny in the car, and he said, I was to hold him down and put a cloth over his face that had chloroform on it. Then we drove a few blocks and turned right, and we pulled in, and there was a van waiting, and we transferred Johnny's body to the van. Well, remember that report I mentioned from that neighbor that was up at that hour of the morning and he kept calling the police? That's what that man was trying to report, what he saw. That was actually the evidence that proved Johnny was taken out of here. Paul Benassi even had the color of the van correct. Now, once we got that information from the man that lived in the house, we never shared it with anyone, not any reporters, news people of any kind, no police, nobody ever knew about that report. And Paul Benassi had all the information correct. Now, there was only one way that Paul would know that, and that was because he was there. So after we had that confirmation, we still didn't share it with anybody, but we were able to move forward in a little bit different direction in the whodunit part. And we continued along that path trying to find the driver of that car. We knew the names of the other people in the car itself, but the van was separate. We didn't know who drove that, nor did we have a license plate number, because it was at the very early morning hours and it wasn't quite bright daylight yet, and it was a little too far away from the resident in the house to see a license plate. He could see the van and he could see them loading something into it because of streetlights, but it was parked at the wrong angle for him to see the license plate. So that didn't help us too much with that part. However, moving along with all of that, that is about the same time that the whole Franklin Credit Union story broke loose over in Omaha, when 80 children came forward talking of abuse and how they were used by this group.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And that's about the time Paul Benassi was thrown in jail too. And most all of the 80 some children recanted their stories. The only three actually that didn't recant was Paul Benassi, Alicia Owens, and one other young man. And I had never met him or Alicia Owen, but I knew of their stories because through our private investigators, because they were from Omaha as well. And, you know, we were on many talk shows, and I was invited to speak at many different types of organizations, civic organizations, church groups, schools with young children. I was on the road all the time, every week, and that's how we devoted our time to awareness about this problem, because I knew that they would come back and take another child. I could just feel it. And June of 1984, I had a man call and say that he had information that we needed for the case. So we arranged to go talk with him. And during that talk, he said there's going to be another kidnapping. It'll be the second Sunday in August. It will be another paper boy. And it will be on the south side of Des Moines.
Now this is important, folks.
Yes,
because
it is.
This is, listen very closely. Go ahead, Nori.
So I said, well, how did you come upon this information? And he said, well, I can't reveal my source. But he wanted me to go to the Des Moines Police Department and give them this information, because it would fall in their jurisdiction. You know, we were in West Des Moines, so we had the West Des Moines police. This other kidnapping that was supposed to take place was going to be in the Des Moines Police Department jurisdiction. So I said, well, why don't you take it to the police yourself? Why are you wanting me to do it? And he said, well, they'll try to force me to give up my source. And I said, well, if I go to the police department, I'm going to give them your name. He said, that's fine. So what would be the difference there? I didn't follow his reasoning, but I made a trip to the Des Moines Police Department. They would not even let me talk to a detective. No one. I was stopped at the front desk, and they said, we know that you've been under a terrible strain and that you probably have imagined this. So I left the Des Moines Police Department. They wouldn't let me talk to anybody. They wouldn't take a statement. They didn't even want to hear the tape recording of this man. We recorded it. We took a tape recorder with us when we went to the meeting. And we asked, do you mind if we record this so we don't forget any of your details? And I had that. It was a cassette tape. Des Moines Police didn't even want to listen to it. So from there, I went to the TV stations and I talked to the program manager of each station. And they were kind and all of that and took down a few notes, you know. And then I went to the newspaper to one particular reporter who had been given the Johnny Gosch story and did most of the articles throughout all the years. So I told other people. Well, that was in June. Come August, the second weekend in Des Moines, ABC 2020 was in Des Moines filming another episode of Johnny's story. They took an interest in Johnny's case and periodically...
I saw that interview, yes.
Yeah, and they would periodically come to Des Moines to do updates. So they were in town for that. So after we did our interviews with them, I said, there's something you should listen to. So I played the tape for the producer. Well, she became very interested in this, and she said, well, that's quite a clue. Have you taken it to the police? So I told her the whole thing about going to the police. They didn't want to hear it, so I went to the news stations and the Des Moines Register. And she said, well, I'm sending my film crew back to New York tonight on a plane, but I'm staying over. I want to see what happens tomorrow, because that next day was going to be the second Sunday in August. Well, early that morning, the second Sunday in August, our phone rings at home. And it was a reporter from one of the stations I had visited with this information. And it was a young man. And he was so out of breath. He kept saying, Mrs. Gosch, there's been another kidnapping. Exactly as you said it would happen. Exactly. And they're calling in FBI agents from Quantico, 18 of them, to come here to work on this case. And I said to him, well, how did you know what I said? I didn't talk to you. I spoke with your program director at the station. He said, well, after you left, he came out into the newsroom and told us what you said, and we all laughed about it and thought you were nuts. I said, what do you think now that another child has been taken? When somebody could have patrolled that area, or at least the media could have watched the area. I said, now there's another child gone, isn't there?
Now, Noreen, during all this, up to this point, what is the community reaction like?
We had a lot of support from the public, amazing support. And there wasn't a day that I would go out of my house to go to work or to even go to the grocery store, but that people didn't come up to me and say, we are praying for you and your boy. And they did a lot of other things to help as well. We had a lot of support, but not from the police, and certainly not from the FBI.
Absolutely.
And,
unbelievable.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
The way I worked it, and it was our senator's suggestion, Senator Grassley, he was kind enough to call me and had one of his office staff do it, came up with the idea that when we had a lead on Johnny's case, we were to call his office with the details. Grassley would then send that over to the FBI headquarters in D.C. Then the headquarters in D.C. would send the message out to the FBI locally in our town that they had to, investigate this and write up a report and send it back to the FBI office. the FBI office in turn had to send it to Senator Grassley, and I would get a copy. That's how we did it for a year. And then one day, the head director of the FBI in our town came to my office, and he walked in and he said, "You think you're really smart, don't you?" I said, "I don't know what you're talking about." And he said, "Well, you're running everything through Senator Grassley's office to force us to investigate." I said, "Well, that is your job, but you just didn't want to do it willingly." And I said, "Got a question for you." I said, "When you all go through FBI school, do you have some people that graduate at the highest level, grade point-wise, in your classes?" "Well, yes." I said, "Do you have people in the middle?" "Yes." And I said, "Do you have people at the bottom that just barely scrape through?" "Well, yes." And I said, "Well, what happens with the guys that are on the lower end of this curve?" And he said, "Well, they go to the lower crime areas." And I said, "Well, I rest my case."
Amazing. Unbelievable.
And he sat there and he said, "You are the most irritating woman I have ever met." And he said, "You never raise your voice." And I said, "Well, I assume you have perfect hearing unless you've got a problem. I can talk louder if you would like me to, but I think you're hearing me okay."
I would have asked him, "Have you ever lost your child?" That's what I would have.
I did. I said, you can walk down your hallway or whatever your situation in your house plan is, and you can see your kids in their beds at night, can't you?" And he said, "Well, yes." And I said, "I can't. And you're here trying to tell me that you're objecting to the way Senator Grassley set this up to help me when my child is gone?" I said, "What's wrong with you people?" I knew that with that, when I had a little more time on my hands, that I was going to go after the FBI. And I did, full force. I testified.
Yes, you did. And we are going to talk about that here in a few minutes. Maureen, mm-hmm. Let's give you a break real quick.
Okay.
When we get on the other side, we're going to ask Maureen about her testifying, starting these organizations, and a lot more. We're going to run long, guys, tonight, so bear with us. Chris, let's give us a break.
Here's a two-minute break. Visit our sponsors, MyLibertyPage.com, where free speech reigns, and NewTeaPartyMovement.org. Be sure to listen to our immediate partners, the Not Sorry Show, live Tuesdays and Thursdays, 8 p.m. Central, on this platform. Grab you some Georgia sweet tea, hit the can, and we'll be right back.
I'll be there to hurt. On that you can depend and never worry.
Okay, welcome back. Maureen, let's continue on and pick up where, you know, the police blew it, and you had a surprise visit.
Would you repeat that? I'm sorry.
I said, let's pick up where we were at. And at one point, you had a surprise visit from Johnny.
Yes, I did. In December of 1996, I was invited to be on the Lisa Gibbons show. And what they did on that show, they had several mothers who had all had children kidnapped. Some of the children had been found murdered. Some they were still searching for. And then towards the end of the show, they allowed each mother to give a special message just in case their child might be watching. And so I did one for Johnny and told him in the message that I would help him no matter what, just to contact me. And then we'd finish the show and I flew home. In March of 1997, there was a knock at my door one night. It was about 2 in the morning. And I went to the door and looked out and saw a young man standing there. And I could see that there was someone else with him because I could see the other person's shoulder, but I couldn't see the face. And I said, well, who's there? And the voice said, it's me, Mom, it's Johnny. Now, that's not significant to anyone but me. But in our home, when the kids were growing up, we had this rule. If there was a closed door to any one of the bedrooms and one of the other kids wanted to come in or something, they would show the courtesy of knocking. And that's the way I brought the kids up. Johnny always used to say, when you'd say, well, who's there? Who is it? He would always say, it's me, Mom, it's Johnny. He'd say it the same way, the very same way, as that night that I had the visitors. So I opened the door and let them in. I was never introduced to the young man that was with him. Both of the kids had black hair. And Johnny had a lot deeper complexion at that point, and it looked more like a good tan or a self-tanner. He would tan very dark when he would be out in the sun, but this was the middle of winter, so I figured that it was a tanning product of some kind. And what he did was just outlined what happened to him to me. He told me about how they ran their organization and something about the kidnappers themselves.
Now, Noreen, how many years had passed since he was kidnapped till then?
He was about 27 when he came to my door.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm. So he'd been gone for a while.
But you had no doubt it was Johnny.
Correct. And as he explained all of it, I said, well, how is it that you're able to be here now? And he said, well, you outlive your usefulness to these people when you're not a cute kid anymore. And
that is so disgusting.
Yeah.
But go ahead, Mom.
And
go
some
ahead.
Some kids are murdered. Some are just abandoned with no education, no real way to make a decent living, because of the way they had lived. But in the case of Johnny and another kid who both broke loose at the same time, they stole a car that way. And when they did that, and we were filmed for America's Most Wanted, that film was shown and it had more people watching than the history of America's Most Wanted from the first time they ever aired a program. They had more people call in on Johnny's story. But there was a man watching.
I actually remember that episode, yes.
Yeah. But there was a man that was watching that show, and he recognized Johnny. His son had been missing too, and he and Johnny had met where they were being held. And his son was the other kid that helped steal the car. And so they made a trip, the kids did, to that boy's father's home in Milwaukee. Stayed there for 3 days. And then Johnny was leaving there and said something to them about going to a Indian reservation to live, to stay. And so he left. Well, then when the father saw the America's Most Wanted story on Johnny, he realized that the boy that had come to stay in their home, his son's friend, was in fact Johnny Gosch. So he called me. The father did. Nice man. Really, he and his wife had been through a lot with their son's disappearance also. But he was so kind, and he said, I just feel so badly that I didn't know it was your son while he was still here in my home. But see, it was during that couple of weeks, right after the boys were, you know, got free, that he came to see me. And it coincided exactly with a couple of days later, they showed up at this man's home. Johnny stayed there for about 3 days and then moved on. And his son decided to stay at home with his parents for a time. Now, that gentleman has passed away since then, but I'll never forget how kind he was. And even though I didn't get that opportunity right at that time to make any further arrangements for Johnny's to stay someplace, when they were at my home and I said, I can make arrangements for a place for you to stay that would be safe. And he said, you don't understand. If they find out I've been here, they'll kill you. Because, see, they had always threatened the kids. Well, if you try to get away, if you try to flee or contact police or anything, we'll kill your family. And that's what these kids grew up with from the time they were kidnapped. So if they were go ahead.
I've seen so many people post, well, why didn't you tackle him? Why didn't you call the police when he came to your house?
The police, after their other performance, would have been the very last people I would have ever called. And I did not. And I promised my son that night that I would not tell anyone he had been here. And I kept that promise.
I think that's a smart mom.
Yeah. I kept that promise until I was subpoenaed to be on a witness stand, and I was asked the question, have you ever spoken to or seen your son since he's been kidnapped? And I remained silent, and the judge warned me that I needed to answer the question or I'd be held in contempt. And I said, I saw my son once, and that's all I said. I refused to give any details. And I got information from him that was helpful to us with what we were doing, because Johnny saw that TV show I was on. And I had said on that TV show, if you'll just contact me, I will do everything in my power to help you, no matter what it is. Well, then he came here. And that also coincided with that maybe a 2 week period when they ended up staying at this other kid's dad's house. And then that father recognized that it was Johnny that had stayed there, because very shortly after that is when the America's Most Wanted show aired. So it all kind of came at around the same time. Now, the interesting thing with these cases, for a while, you might have a number of leads or information that is useful. Then you might go 3 or 4 years before you hear anything again. These cases are hard to work, and you have to have a lot of persistence, patience, and find ways to just make yourself keep on keeping on. Get up each day knowing you have something to do in that day. And it's very, very difficult, especially when you are working the case on your own. I had great detectives. I can't say enough about them. But when I hired detectives, I got men who, some of them had been in law enforcement and had retired and then went into the private sector as a, you know, investigator. And they knew how to get information. They knew how to process it so that you could, or what to look for to take it into a court case if it ever happened. And for that, I was grateful, because when I would get the reports, and I told them right from the beginning, you will be paid as long as the reports come only to me. If I ever hear that you have shared a report with the press or with the police or the FBI, I will not pay you one red cent. So that's kind of the agreement we had.
The last I checked on the FBI, the case is a cold case still open.
That's just a line they give people. Oh, yes, we're going to keep the case open. Well, big deal. They didn't do anything for all these years, you know? What were they thinking they were going to do later on down the road? Nothing. Double zeros. And that's exactly what they performed.
You know, I want to talk real quick, Doreen, about, you know, we talk about our media today, how screwed up it is. But it was screwed up back then.
Yes, it was. It's worse now, I believe. But back then, it was a challenge. And people were so quick to want to second guess and criticize. I had enough of that to last me a lifetime. So I finally got to the point. Oh, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
I was going to say, I finally got to the point that when people would, you know, start going after me verbally, I would just smile and I'd say, you know, you should be really feeling fortunate that with all the kidnappings that have been taking place throughout the United States, that your child has been spared. What if that happened to you? Police said, no, he's nothing but a runaway. The FBI said, you have to prove your child's life is in danger. What would you do? I said, number one, the first thing you'd do is call me. And I know that to be a fact because there have been people that have called me because they couldn't get the help from the police in other areas. And they have called me wanting some kind of assistance of what to do if the police don't help, because there are police that don't. Now, fast forwarding a little bit more through the case, information came to me from a very reliable source that when they had these parties that were organized through Franklin and Larry King, that particular Larry King, over in Omaha, two of the people that attended those parties were everything from drugs, booze, and sex with young kids was provided. That two guests at those parties was our police chief and the police chief from Omaha. Bingo. That's why the police chief came down so hard on me, pushed at me all the time, didn't want us hiring a private investigator, saying Johnny was nothing but a runaway. He was protecting his own behind. He was guilty he was guilty of being involved. That's what the deal was.
It just makes me sick. Now, Noreen, let's move forward. And now you've testified in front of the Senate, Congress, and I believe were directly responsible for the start of the Center for the Missing and Exploited Children.
I was one of the ones that helped with the testimony, my testimony, and that was before the Justice Department, because they were seeking the first $10 million to start the Justice or the National Center for Missing Children. And when I was very blunt in my speech, they had assembled 50 parents that each were told to tell their story, tell what went right in the case through law enforcement and what went wrong. Because what they were trying to do was justify the need for the $10 million to start the National Center. And in my speech, I was very, very direct with everything I said. And one of the directors at the National Center, who's still there yet today, unless he's retired by now, he told me, he says, Noreen, there's talking about your speech out here. Because of you, we got the first $10 million. You put the FBI on the spot.
Yeah. Yep.
And then what I did was demand, in a polite way, that they hold the FBI accountable. That is in their job description. And if the FBI was not going to look for these children, then cut their funding, presenting that to the Justice Department, who releases the money. And I said, cut their funding by a percentage. If they don't want to assume that part of their job description, then delete money that they would have gotten and give it to us to start the National Center. And I put it just like that, and there was dead silence. You could have heard a pin drop in that room, because nobody's ever said cut the funding to the FBI before. And I did, and I meant it. If they weren't going to do that, because every parent that got up to speak said things like what they said to us. Well, it's your responsibility to prove your child's life is in danger. Well, don't you know why your child would be in danger? How did he become in the situation where he was in peril or in danger of being kidnapped? Turn it around on the parents. And I heard one family after another, broken people, because their kids were taken. One after another at that conference, at that hearing, before the Justice Department, get up and say the same thing. See, I was the last speaker of the day. Sometimes there's an advantage to be the last speaker, because you get to hear everything that everybody else is reporting. And it was
exactly.
Yeah. And I could hear those same words that the FBI said to us. And see, by doing that, it got them out of having to take the case. Deniability. So,
Noreen, are there any updates in Johnny's case that we can talk about? Or
there is one, and it came to me about 2 years ago. We now know who is driving the van. It is the correct man, and I know right where he's at. I don't, however, have law enforcement backing me to bring him in, because the West Des Moines police have said that the police chief has said that he does not want any of his detectives helping Noreen Gosch to further or finish or solve the case. And he doesn't care whether I lose all support in the city, whether I move away, or whether I die. And he doesn't care which comes first. And it was one of their own that contacted me to tell me what the police chief said. in a meeting with all the detectives. So for that reason, I have not gone to the police with this latest information. I have just been working a different strategy, but we know who it is. We have his photograph. We have all of the information. He is a first class pedophile, and he's the one that was driving the van. And that's the only significant change we've had in a number of years now. But that was worth its weight in gold when I got that information.
Absolutely. Maureen, tell us about Johnny's foundation.
The foundation was started on November 12th, 1982. Johnny's birthday is when we formed it. And it was done for two purposes. One, it handled all the business end of searching for Johnny. The other side of it was awareness to the public and creating legislation to protect children, which we did. I traveled so much through all those years and gave so many speeches to all these different organizations, churches, and schools. I had films for the kids, and parents were encouraged to come with their children to the programs. And it was done in a language where the children were not terrified in the meeting. The films were appropriate for children to learn more about being careful. And much of the information that we gave was really a profile on pedophiles to give the parents really some tools of what to look for in their own communities. And just about every community I spoke in, within a couple, 3 weeks, there were arrests of pedophiles that took place. Because one thing I always did in every speech was address to the kids that if someone is doing something that is not okay with you, you know it's wrong. It doesn't feel right. It someone is touching you or making suggestive things, and pedophiles can operate on any level. They can be known to the family or they can be strangers. But if that is happening to you, tell somebody you trust. Get some help. Go to somebody that you feel you can trust. And 9 times out of 10, there would be arrests in every community. And I know there was one community, Southern Iowa, that I was at, and one lady from the audience, you know, because there was questions and answers afterwards too. One lady said, well, you know, your statistics are wrong because we have only nice people that live in our community. Well, there happened to have been a young victim of sexual abuse in the auditorium that night where I was speaking. He went and told somebody, this young boy did, and it happened to be the dentist in that town that was doing it.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Another city, right after my book came out, I get to the
Noreen, mention the book, please.
Yes, the book is called Why Johnny Can't Come Home, and I wrote the book in 2001, and it outlines Johnny's case with a lot of the real important details of how we built this case. The book is written in a chronological order, so that somebody that lives, you know, in another country, which I have shipped to other countries, can pick it up and read it and follow it without a lot of going back and forth, like sometimes books are presented. I did mine in a chronological order so that it would be easy to follow. And if people are interested in the book, they can contact me at 1258 Office Park Road, number 2, West Des Moines, Iowa, 50265. And they can address the request to me. And that is my office. And I have a limited amount of books to to ship now because my supply is getting low. But the book, and it covers the shipping and everything, would be $25. And it gives a very, very good outline of just how this all happened. And to prove even further, you know, the information that we got from that man that shared that there would be another kidnapping, that was Eugene Martin's kidnapping. Then, years later, 25 years later, I get a call from the National Center for Missing Children. And they said, did you know that you have a third kidnapped boy from your city? And I said, no, I didn't. Well, that was Mark Allen. Nice young boy, 13, lived on the south side of Des Moines. And when he was kidnapped, he wasn't a paper boy, but he was going to go to a friend's house after school to work on a project that they had to do for school. And it was maybe a 3-block walk. So he said to his mom, she was making pizza that night, and he said, save me a piece of pizza. I'll be hungry when I get back. And so he started walking toward his friend's house, and he was kidnapped in March of 1986. And,
absolutely it's heartbreaking.
Mm-hmm. But there was no TV shows. There was no stories in the newspaper about that boy. 25 years later, the National Center called me and said, we will ship you Mark's file. So as soon as I got it, I called the WHO radio here in town that has the greatest coverage throughout the state of Iowa. And I asked the one gentleman that always had a talk show in the morning if I could come on the show sometime, you know, when he has an opening. And he said, is there something new on Johnny's case? I said, no, but you're not going to believe what I'm going to bring to you. What that mother went through with no help from the police. And they had the audacity to say to her, just stay at home. Don't say anything. Don't tell people your son's missing. Don't talk about it to anyone. And for God's sake, don't call Noreen Gosh. She's nothing but a troublemaker. That's what the police told her.
I'm going to tell you right now, we're not going to stay at home. We're not going to be quiet. I want to bring the original producers back, George and Jorge.
Okay,
George, Jorge, are you here?
I'm here.
You got some thoughts?
Well, I just want to get her tenacity to keep this story alive is incredible. And I know she just basically touched upon quickly because of the time limits, but I just wanted to let people know that there's a much bigger story behind this, and this is not an isolated incident. The Paul Benashi was he himself kidnapped as a child, as an 8-year-old child, and he was under the control of a Michael Aquino, and I suggest that you look him up. This guy is the most evil military. He ran the psychological warfare in the army, and through that there was ritual sex abuse of children in a daycare center. And then touching upon the Franklin Bank scandal, that ties into the Satanic Finders cult.
Mm-hmm.
And then that tied into MK Ultra, which is a program used to produce spies, drug mules, prostitutes, assassins, and they kidnap children. And they brainwash them and use all types of psychological manipulation to break them of their personalities.
Had you heard that Michael Aquino died?
Oh no, I don't blame.
He died within like a year and a half ago.
I have no pity on him. If you read about his biography, Just his picture alone will send shivers up the spine.
He was a very evil person.
Yeah.
George, get in here real quick. Any thoughts for Doreen?
Well, you know, first, I just have to say, very, very compelling to listen to your story. And as a parent, it's hard, you know, it's hard for me to imagine, you know, going through any of it, let alone all of these years. Thank you for coming on and for keeping this story alive as well. But I do have just kind of a quick question. So the only time that you've seen Johnny is when he came that one time, and there's been no more communication or anything?
There has not been any more personal communication. I have had some through the internet. Email.
Gotcha.
Okay. Some different things that have taken place. But like I said, set your watch by it happening. It's whenever. And it's maybe months in between anything that comes about. I know that one time we had a number of the kids, and I called them kids because they were at the time. And I was working with James Rothstein, who was a retired New York police detective whose specialty was human trafficking. And he joined the team and worked with me. And we were in the process of trying to provide safety for these kids if they were willing to come forward. And we about had it agreed upon, and then the kids got scared and said it would mean their own death or death of their loved ones if they did it. So they backed out. However, things they told us was there has to be a few more deaths of the people that were in charge before they would feel safe to come forward. Well, with Aquino dying, and then there's been a couple of others that have died that I knew were involved, maybe it's going to happen before it's over. I don't know. But that's what we were told by the kids themselves. And there's a number of these boys that are still alive. They're not all dead.
So do you feel like that – I was going to say, do you feel like you're maybe – I mean, is your gut telling you that you may be on the cusp of this nightmare finally beginning to close a little bit?
That would be my hope, yes. I don't have any concrete evidence or information on that part of it, only what the boys said. And then I got word only about 3 months ago, Keno's death.
Yeah.
And he had been dead for a year, and I just got the information a couple months ago. So it wasn't highly publicized, but then I did do some checking, and he did die. And like I said, there was one other man that locally I know was involved. And in fact, the man that was giving all the information about Eugene Martin's kidnapping and wanted me to go to the police, he just died. Mm-hmm. 2 weeks ago.
Oh.
Yes.
Wow.
And,
absolutely.
Yeah, that's huge. That's huge. Yeah. So we've had two more deaths in the last 2 years of people that participated in this mess. And you see, we were fortunate that we did have witnesses. And Paul Benassi himself testified in court that in February of 1999, that he actually saw the colonel, he called him, saw him count out the money and lay it on the table to pay the kidnappers for taking Johnny.
No.
Yes. Unbelievable.
So
George, it's just unbelievable.
So with that information, and he testified in court, And the judge ruled that Benassi was telling the truth. When he did that, he did us a big favor of telling us how much and that they saw the money being counted out. Benassi wasn't the only one that saw it. There was a couple of other young people in the area, in the location that they were at when they did the buying of Johnny and counted the money out. But you see, back then, this wasn't called human trafficking yet. They hadn't even given it a name back when we had all this discovery taking place.
Yeah.
And
well,
I do know that when President Trump took office, one of the first things he did was really start to bear down on the human trafficking. And he placed Senator Scalise in charge of it. And then we had the shooting of all of the people that were playing a round of baseball. And Scalise was one of the ones that was shot and almost died. And with the human trafficking being put on the forefront, because you see, it's not just the surface. As you pointed out, this goes so much deeper than just the taking of children. The money that is generated from human trafficking is in the billions every year. It rivals drug sales. Now, for it to have that much revenue, there has to be something pretty big going on and people to look the other way to allow it to continue. And that is probably part of the swamp.
Yeah, the swamp is a problem. Noreen,
it is.
As a sexually abused preteen, I can't thank you enough for your courage, your voice. Unfortunately, your pain has helped so many. We pray for you and Johnny.
Thank you.
Jorge, we got to get out of here because we're going to hit the break.
Sure.
And they're going to cut us off.
Okay.
But thanks again, Noreen. Our special guests, Jorge, George, executive producer from the Not Sorry Show. Next week, our political roundtable, Jim, Randy from the New Tea Party Movement.org, Rocco from MyLibertyPage.com returns. Co-hosts Jorge and Kevin will be back. Thanks for joining us, folks. Get us out of here, Chris.
Noreen, this is Chris. And before we get out, we would like to wish Johnny a happy 50th birthday this year, correct?
Yeah, I know.
We'd
yeah,
like
absolutely.
To wish him a happy 50th, and we hope that he is listening somewhere along the line.
I do, too. I don't have any.
Join Robbie and the crew on the Not Sorry Show, 8 p.m. Central, DLive, and Blog Talk Radio, Tuesdays and Thursdays. Unapologetic commentary by unapologetic people. It's the Not Sorry Show, a media partner with Radio Infidel.